ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If you've ever tried to implement a new workplace practice or a national recycling program, you'll know that getting people to change their behaviour can be a challenge. So if we do want to create change, how can we make sure we're taking people with us and not just shouting into the void? And this kind of behaviour change science applies to everything from tiny local groups to community-wide initiatives. So you will have come across the principles we're going to discuss today somewhere already, I'm sure. Professor Liam Smith is the director and co-founder of Behaviour Works Australia, which is a behaviour change research enterprise operating out of Monash University in Melbourne. And he's co-edited a new book that gets into the nitty-gritty of inspiring change. Guess what it's called? Yes. Inspiring change. Liam, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
Now, Behaviour Works Australia works with government and industry and communities to make different kinds of change using behavioural science principles. But on those kind of larger scales, why is it so hard to make change? Why is it harder than changing one person's ways?
Well, I think when you're trying to change the behaviour of a lot of people, there are actually lots of audiences. It's not just one group of people. For example, if you think about trying to get someone to, say, put solar panels on their roof, some people might want to do it to save money, others might want to do it for environmental reasons, and some might not want to do it at all, and some might, you know, disagree with the energy transition. So there are different audiences that will need different sort of approaches or interventions to try and change their behaviour. So it's not one that's often going to solve the problem for everybody. That said, there are times when we do get that kind of mass change. And I guess a recent example of that would have been in the COVID situation, where we had a lot of people changing behaviour all at once. And we could argue maybe that happened because there was a spread of norms. So it became the norm to wear masks, or the norm to social distance, or the norm to work from home.
And in some places.
In some places, yeah, particularly here in Melbourne. And we saw the sort of the spread of the behaviour through a different sort of pathway. And so you can get changed through that way, but convincing a lot of people is difficult because there's just so many types of people.
Well, and a lot of that change was imposed top down and had sanctions attached to it too. Do you find that that's more effective, or is it better to go, you know, hey people, let's all get on board willingly?
So I think sanctions and regulations and laws can be very effective tools. And I guess the question to people who are deciding whether to use those tools is whether they're happy to spend the political capital that it takes in order to put those things through, and whether the benefits are truly worth it. They certainly are effective, particularly, I think, in a country like Australia, where we tend to be fairly compliant. And so those sorts of tools are effective. But you don't want to be applying those for everything. You don't want to have rules for, you know, how you walk down the street or what type of product you buy at a supermarket. And so we tend to save them for situations where we really feel it's worth using them.
Social norms are an interesting one too, aren't they? The book is full of, you know, cautions about them and the importance of tapping into them. But they would vary too, wouldn't they, for people, depending on your cultural background, certainly on your gender, your age, for example. How do you use them effectively?
Yeah, so they certainly are different. We kind of categorise social norms or norms into three kind of types. One type is what we call injunctive norm. It's not a great name because it doesn't have a lot of meaning for people outside of psychology. But really that first refers to individuals or groups of people who matter to us, whose opinions we care about. And if we can use those people to deliver a message or ask us to do a behaviour, it's likely to be more effective. But there are other types of norms as well. So we've also got what we call descriptive norms, which is our understanding of what everyone else is doing. If you go onto Netflix, you might see what's the most viewed thing today, and you'll be tempted to follow that, or you might see something on social media that's going viral, and you're interested in following it because we're essentially herd animals and we like to follow herds. And so those sorts of descriptive norms are really, really powerful in both ways, importantly. So positives, yes, if lots of people are doing a desired behaviour, but also if they're doing an undesirable behaviour, that can also influence us to do undesirable things as well. So injunctive norms, descriptive norms, and we also sometimes talk about personal norms, which is the pressure we put on ourselves. So sometimes we say, I would do that because I'm not that type, I wouldn't do that because I'm not that type of person, or I would because I am. And so those are the three types of norms. And I think they do cut across all cultures, to your question. So it's not unique to particular cultures, but But they're the three types that we often use and talk about.
I love some of the examples in your book, Inspiring Change, Professor Liam Smith. There's a great one about designing signs in national parks to encourage people to stay on the track. And the chapter pretty much opens with the line, "You are not normal. They're not like you," which is this guiding force that helped you design the appropriate signs. Walk us through that example briefly.
Yeah, so that was a very early example, actually, before BehaviourWorks was formed. A colleague of mine, Jim Curtis, who established BehaviourWorks with me, was doing some work trying to encourage people to stay on the track down at Port Campbell National Park, which is where the 12 Apostles are on the southern coast of Victoria. And one of the issues was people were leaving off the track, and obviously that causes puts them in danger, but also damages vegetation. And so I think one of the first things we did in that project was to mock up some different ways or signs that might work to keep people on the track. And we put them in front of park managers and said, "What do you think will work best?" And the one they chose was actually one that didn't work very well at all when we tested it. And that kind of led us, and we kind of knew this, but it really emphasised this principle that designing behaviour change programs for others is really difficult because we often use ourselves as the benchmark, as the case study, like, "Oh, that would work on me," or "That wouldn't work on me, so it's a good one or a bad one." But actually, our target audience by definition are different to us. They're different. And so we need to get inside their heads and understand what they think and what might be going through their heads. So
that's right, because the park managers are like, "Can you do the right thing, please?"
Yeah, and they had a picture of a park ranger saying, you know, sort of an authority figure. But actually what we found was that people left the track to get good photos. And so a sign that said, "Stay on the track, you'll get the best photos if you do," from a photographer, was really effective at encouraging people to stay on the track.
A fictional photographer in the example.
It was, yes.
Sure, fictional. That doesn't happen in real life. I love, too, that there's another line in the book. "A commonly held belief is that when someone is aware of what they should do, they will simply do it," which you illustrate is not a useful belief to take into change making. We're speaking with Professor Liam Smith, who's the director and co-founder of BehaviourWorks Australia, a behaviour change research body at Monash University. They've written a book called Inspiring Change, which has some useful tips for people looking to make change in their communities. You have to also understand the people involved, don't you? There's the kind of people and the emotions and the context of their lives, as well as the evidence of whatever you're trying to convince people of. And there's a really interesting example of the transfer of a patient from a regional to a metro hospital. Can you tell us how that operates in that context?
Yeah, so this is some work we did with the Victorian Managed Insurance Authority, which is the public insurer, and we did a series of projects with them looking at how we can improve hospital outcomes for patients. The transfer of patients from a rural or regional hospital to a city hospital is often needed because the city hospital has equipment that basically isn't available in a rural hospital. But there are interesting dynamics at play here. Essentially, it boils down to a phone call where a doctor at a regional hospital is trying to convince a doctor at a metropolitan hospital to take their patient. And so in that case, there were lots of things at play here, like power dynamics, certainly busyness. Often, you know, if a call came in towards the end of a shift, it would be hard to accommodate. Like, you know, it would take some time and it would mean delays. And so there were a few things at play that we found really got in the way, I guess, of enabling that to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, people, as you said, are varied and complicated and potentially different to how we assume they are. So there's a lot going on in behaviour change science. I was thinking, too, about the line between individual and systemic kind of influences on people's behaviours. And the curbside recycling example was just fascinating in that regard, because didn't they go in going, "Well, we want to make people do different things at home, so we think we should educate them more about what to do." But it was something quite different at the heart of that issue, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, Hilary, you've really touched on something that we focused very heavily on at the moment. It's not so much in the book, a little bit towards the end, but certainly we've got a number of researchers exploring the relationships between systems and behaviour and how each influences each other. And that example you cite of contamination in recycling is a classic one, right? So why is it that basically our recycling levels have plateaued? They really haven't changed for quite some time. We're not bad at it, but there's certainly room to move. And actually, when you try and understand the systemic drivers, and a doctoral student of mine called Jenny Macklin, who has done a lot of work on this, you find things like certainly knowledge and the like are relevant, but equally things like mixed packaging is so a packaging that will have two recycled or one recyclable and non-recyclable product in it. Mm-hmm. Differences in schemes between one area and another, differences in bins between one area and another. So they ought to be things that we can sort out, but they are more systemic drivers of contamination and poor recycling than those things that go on between the ears, I guess, of people that are trying to do it.
Yep, so don't waste your money on a public education campaign. Fix the collection and sorting systems. I know my mum has to check the triangles on the bottom of things before she
puts
it in
the bin. And they're different for every council, right? So it's sort of really problematic, particularly if you move.
Yes, yeah. Liam, we've been talking mainly about behavioural change, I guess, within communities or groups of individuals rather than workplaces or organisations. But I couldn't believe it when I read that in your words in the book. Most organisational change programs simply don't work, statistically speaking. Why is that? Do we know?
Well, I'd probably step back and say a lot of behaviour change programs simply don't work. And the answer to that question is because we're creatures of habit. We tend to do what we do most of the time, or most of the time we do what we do most of the time. And so changing behaviour is hard. If you think about a new time you formed a habit, probably wasn't very recently, and it's hard, and we all have New Year's resolutions and often don't follow through with them. So there's lots of difficulties, I guess, in getting any change. I think organisations also have supporting structures that really ensure that things, the behaviour sort of flows, a bit like that conversation we had about the system driving the behaviour. So there's power structures, there's organisational dynamics, there's departments, there's all these things that don't change. And so trying to change a behaviour within that context can be really, really tricky. So, yeah, it's one of those things that, it's wise to pay attention to, I guess, trying to persuade people to do things differently, but at the same time to also have your eye on what you can change in the system that might enable that behaviour as well.
Yeah, I love the advice in the book to focus on what you can change and don't go beyond the here be dragons sign on the map.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going to bother with that. Let's just finish up, Liam, by going back to the start in a sense and saying, you know, how do you frame the question that you go into the behaviour change project with? Because in the book you explain how it might not be the question that you think it is that's relevant when you talk to the people involved.
Yeah, look, it's one of those. So we talk a lot about what's your question in the review, the evidence review chapter, which is the very first chapter. And I think as a general rule, it's a really good thing to go and look at the evidence, right? So, and there are lots of evidence databases out there. So, you know, the Cochrane database or the Campbell collaboration or social systems evidence, health systems evidence. There are lots of these existing places where you can just go and find out what others have found out before. And build on that. So that question often comes at the start, and it sort of helps you search for the right evidence that will help you answer the question. The question we often ask in behavioural science is what drives the behaviour? So why are people doing the things they do? And there's often some evidence on that. And what works to change behaviour? They're the two kind of questions we get to. But often at the start of a project, we just have a problem. Like, we need to use less energy. So that's not very behaviour focused. And behaviour focused need to hone in on, you know, putting solar on your roof or, you know, swapping to a heat pump or something. But the evidence of the question, we might be more broad, but they'll often fit into one of those two categories, what works and what drives behaviour.
Let's finish up with a text from Lucy in Lismore. Great signage at Ballina Airport. No one smokes here anymore. Seemed to be effective, she says. Wonderful. Liam, thanks so much for telling us just a little bit about your field on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary.
Professor Liam Smith, the director and co-founder of Behaviour Works Australia and one of the editors of the new book, Inspiring Change.
Getting in touch with ABCRN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.